Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Earlier this year, we did a week-long series on the cocktail of chemicals that we're exposed to on a daily basis. These chemicals are used in everyday products, and they have been linked to many serious health issues, including cancer, infertility, and nervous system damage. 84,000 chemicals have been registered for commercial use. The EPA has regulated just 9 of those. That's far less than 1%. On June 22nd, President Obama signed a bill to amend the Toxic Substances Control Act of 1976. That law was meant to help the EPA regulate the safe production and use of hazardous chemicals. For decades, environmental and health advocates have said that the law was too weak and failed to protect people. And as a result, we've been exposed to toxic chemicals. So what will change with this new law? The industry says it will protect Americans, while environmental groups say it doesn't go far enough. Joining us to talk about the new law are two guests. Dr. Tracy Woodruff is professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences, and Philip R. Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies at UC San Francisco. She's also director of the Program on Reproductive Health and the Environment, and she joins us from her office in San Francisco. Hi, Dr. Woodruff. Welcome to the show.
Hello, and thank you.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Dr. Gretchen Goldman, a lead analyst in the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and she joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Dr. Goldman. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have both of you. So we did a week-long series on toxic chemicals, and we got such a big response because these are products that we all use. In fact, we've all probably used at least 10, maybe 5 to 10 products already today. First off, what is your overall assessment of the new law? The industry says they got on board because they didn't want 50 state laws, and environmental groups say that the new law doesn't go far enough. So, Dr. Woodruff, overall, what's your assessment?
My assessment of the law is that, well, first of all, it is fantastic that people care enough to work on this law. I think different people are being driven by different goals, and I think your statement about the industry being coming to the table because they're concerned about the fact that there's many different laws in different states, I think is a compelling reason to demonstrate why this law is important. I'd say my overall assessment of the law is I think there are some important changes that were made in the law, but I think there's also some important drawbacks that we will be seeing the effect of over the years as it's becoming implemented.
And Dr. Goldman, what are your thoughts? What's your assessment?
I feel similarly. I think it's great to see improvements. This is the first time we've seen improvements in 40 years in this law, so I don't want to underappreciate that big move. And it does have some features that should lead to improvements in the number and kinds of chemicals that are regulated. But this is also not the bill that we would have written. It does have some limitations, and ultimately I think it will all come down to how well it's implemented in the coming years.
So talk a little bit about what this law actually does. It's got a long name, the Frank R. Lautenberg Chemical Safety for the 21st Century Act. It was named after the late New Jersey senator who championed the legislation. And the last time a piece of legislation was passed to regulate these chemicals was in 1976. And so many environmental groups and health groups said, okay, this is ridiculous. This law is so old. Something needs to happen. So Dr. Woodruff, for people who are not familiar with how the regulation currently works, I mean, 84,000 chemicals, it's kind of hard to wrap your head around that.
Right.
But how is the EPA supposed to regulate those chemicals now?
Well, I think that is the big challenge that people were very concerned about changing, which is that it, as you mentioned in the beginning of the show, it's almost impossible to regulate a chemical because the burden of proof that was necessary in order to regulate a chemical was too high. There was both a health burden as well as a kind of a cost-benefit, basically economic standard burden that was placed on each individual chemicals. And it was also very difficult to get the data that EPA needed out of the industry in order to make a decision. So those issues about what's going to be the kind of the standard by which we decide if a chemical should move to becoming regulated, because the thing that's a the downside of the bill is now is a very complicated process has been set up to actually make to end reach the end goal, which the end goal is we would like to see toxic chemicals exposures reduced. But to get to that end goal, there's a while some of the hurdles have been removed, other more subtle hurdles have been put up in its place. So I think the first thing was it was difficult to get the data and then to regulate the chemical. And then for new chemicals, so I think the other important distinction about the law is that new chemicals, that means I'm a manufacturer, I want to make a new chemical, then I go to EPA and ask them to register that. They go through a different process than chemicals that had already been on the marketplace in 1976. So there were thousands of chemicals that were already on the marketplace, and essentially the old law grandfathered them in, saying we're just going to assume you're safe unless we have data to show to the contrary. And that was the key problem in the bill is it's really hard to show something is a problem if you don't have any data. So right now, so that's been changed. Every chemical will have to go through a process where it's prioritized. And these are for existing chemicals. It'll be prioritized, and then if it's identified as being potential to have be not safe for exposure to the public for the use that it's being intended for, then it will go through a process to identify what those risks are, and then it will go through another process if it's identified to be a potential unreasonable risk, another process to set a standard to reduce those risks. So I think the key part about the risk, which is been modified, but there's new hurdles that have been put in place to get to that place of reducing exposures.
And Dr. Goldman, what are your thoughts on this? One easy way to look at this today is that these chemicals are basically innocent until proven guilty. And it's also important to look at what has happened in the past. So a number of articles about this new law point out that when the EPA has attempted to regulate chemicals in the past, the manufacturers have challenged the EPA in court. A website called The Conversation has a piece about this, and they point out that in 1991, a federal appeals court struck down EPA's attempt to ban most uses of asbestos after the agency spent years documenting the leak between asbestos exposure and cancer and lung disease. And most experts believe that this decision dealt a crippling blow to the law by making it nearly impossible to remove hazardous chemicals from the market. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, this certainly was a huge setback back then. And so we've seen some big changes in this new law, and I think it should have a positive impact if it's implemented correctly. I think, you know, as we've been mentioning, that to go through the 84,000 chemicals under the old law would have taken decades for the agency, given the rate it was currently going. And what this new law does is that it provides a sustained funding source for the agency to be able to move forward on that, and it gives it more authority to move forward. As we're discussing, it shifts that burden of proof so that there isn't quite the same level of burden on the EPA to prove of all this, to be able to definitively prove of risks. And so this, in theory, should allow the agency to go a little faster and be able to regulate these chemicals that we know do present health risks but haven't been sufficiently regulated. And importantly, the new law does include time limits. So there's specific time limits inside of the law that say the agency only has so much time to do this stage of the process and the next stage of the process. And so what this should do is ensure that we aren't continuously in the situation where we have chemicals that we know are unsafe, but they continue to be used for years and years and years as we work up the process. And so I'm hopeful that some of this should be improved under the new bill, and we should be able to finally get to regulating asbestos and formaldehyde and other sorts of chemicals that we know are harmful but were originally grandfathered in way back in 1976 when this was passed.
Dr. Woodruff, under the new law, would manufacturers have the power to challenge the EPA in court? So if the EPA comes out and says we need to ban a certain chemical, like they did in 1989 when they said we needed to ban asbestos, will manufacturers still be able to challenge the EPA in court?
Well, I think that's going to be actually a very interesting part of this law, because I believe that all all decisions that EPA makes along the way will be litigated, and actually that is a way most, I mean, EPA, most implementation of EPA, or actually all implementation of EPA laws, a lot of it is put out by EPA, and then it's challenged in the court, and then a final decision is made by the court. So there will be litigation along the way for all the decision points that that EPA is making in terms of the process. I just wanted to say, I mean, it is true that there's timelines in the law, but that they EPA has a kind of a minimum amount of chemicals that they have to prioritize every year, and then once it's prioritized and identified as a potential to be unsafe to the public, they then have a fixed timeline by which they have to evaluate that chemical and make a final decision on it. But they only have to have, I think it's 20 chemicals in their pipeline at a time. So it still will be pretty slow for them to go through all the chemicals in the group. And also, there's a very important thing about this law that's different than how other types of manufactured chemicals are dealt with, which is there's no minimum data set required for these chemicals, meaning that when manufacturers come to EPA, they don't have to say, I have these types of data that I've already done to evaluate whether this chemical is a potential potentially harmful for human exposures. This is different than how pharmaceuticals are treated, or even active ingredient pesticides, which is covered under a different law that EPA administers. And it's different than how this law is administered in Europe. So I think that distinction about what's the amount of data that EPA, first of all, EPA will have to ask for data in order to evaluate those chemicals, and how they get that data will be a very key part of the success of the implementation of the law.
The Environmental Working Group has suggested that asbestos, bisphenol A, phthalates, and flame retardants should be among the first 10 chemicals evaluated by the EPA. First of all, Dr. Woodruff, these words, a lot of people aren't familiar with these things, but they are in everyday products. So can you tell us bisphenol A, what is that in that we use on a regular basis?
Yeah, BPA, it's a plasticizer chemical or used in plastics. This was used a lot in those hard polycarbonate plastics. So they were used a lot in water bottles, for example, or what had been used in baby bottles. It's actually been phased out and made illegal, for example, in the state of California. They're also used in those receipts that you get from different, like the ATM receipts or your cash register receipts. They're also found in the lining of cans. So people are exposed to them from BPA leaching from the lining of cans and getting into food. Those are some of the uses those are some of the places where BPA is used. We measure BPA in most people in the population, so people are exposed to BPA all the time. And I would note, and this is going to be an interesting piece of the law, is that the state of California has declared BPA reproductive toxicant under Proposition 65. I don't know if we're going to cover this, but they're one of the things in the law is that the new law is that certain types of activities by the states will be preempted, but Proposition 65 will not be preempted under the new law. So any decisions made by the state of California for that in compliance with that that bill or law will not be preempted by EPA. So it'll be very interesting to see if EPA picks BPA as a chemical to evaluate. And the state of California has already said it's a reproductive toxicant. How will EPA deal with that? That will be a very good test case.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought this up. I mean, BPA is an interesting one to talk about because so many products now say BPA-free. In fact, yep. I went to the store recently to buy a juicer, and it didn't have BPA on the box, but the salesman said, oh, and don't worry, this is BPA-free. He basically said companies are now trying not to use BPA because so many customers are asking about it.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point because a lot of groups are also very interested in looking at the marketplace as a driver for a change. So in this case, a lot of changes were made to products like the baby bottles, like the juicer, like a lot of these hard plastic bottles. People took BPA out before there were before there were regulations because there was a lot of information being put out by the scientists saying that BPA is a problem. The challenge here is you don't know what they put in instead, right? Because some of the people are concerned about the substitutes. So that's an issue that we, you know, if there's going to be a new use of a chemical, then EPA could actually consider that. In this case, maybe it's PPS, which is kind of its chemical cousin of BPA. But I think that's a big, that marketplace represents an opportunity for change. But I also think that if EPA comes out and says, oh, we're going to look at BPA and we declare it safe, let's say they did do that, then it has, you know, that's going to create some, A, that'll conflict, would that conflict with California? What's going to happen in, you know, in the marketplace? I think those are some of the things that will be playing out. That's why it's so important about how the decisions are going to be made at EPA, because, you know, if you're a manufacturer and you're using a chemical, it's in your best interest to have EPA declare that chemical essentially as safe.
Today we are talking about the newly amended Toxic Substances Control Act of 1976. President Obama signed a bill to amend it on June 22nd. And that law, it's a very old law. It's been criticized by environmental and health groups for decades. They said that it has no teeth. It really doesn't do its job in protecting citizens from harmful chemicals. And so today we're talking about what this new law will do, and will the EPA actually have the power that it needs to regulate harmful chemicals. Dr. Tracy Woodruff is professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at UC San Francisco and director of the Program on Reproductive Health and the Environment. Dr. Gretchen Goldman is a lead analyst in the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And if you have any questions or comments about chemicals and what we use on a daily basis, we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about this new law? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio. And Dr. Goldman, what other chemicals would you add to the list? Last year, you wrote a piece called "Excuse Me, Sir, Are There Chemicals in That? Why the Law TCSA Reform Needs to Improve Our Chemical Safety." And you were writing it as the perspective of a new mom.
I was, yeah. I was pregnant at the time and working in this area, of course. I was very aware of different chemicals and the sensitivity of having a growing baby in you and the importance of making sure that the chemicals they're exposed to are safe. And so I was very concerned about that and on the personal level in addition to my day job. And so I found myself really looking to see what kinds of policies were in place, and if there were not policies in place, as we know, TSCA rule for short doesn't cover a lot of chemicals that it should. I did find myself trying to read labels and trying to look at different product ingredients to see to make sure that I was limiting my exposure to any chemicals that might be harmful for my growing baby. And so, I made me more curious about it and really opened my eyes to the extent of challenges here. And so one other chemical that I was concerned about, we discussed BPA, and can lining as being one very common exposure pathway for people. But another area that I was really concerned about was my exposure to flame retardants, as those are in almost everything, and any sort of, mattresses and couches and anything with sort of soft padding often has flame retardant chemicals in it. And so I've tried very hard to get specific baby products in particular that didn't have those in them, and I did find it to be a challenge. And so I really was saw firsthand the limitations of the old TSCA and how it has not been sufficient. So I think flame retardants is another good category of chemicals that I'd like to see the EPA take up first in their first set of chemicals. I know this is one that's being looked at and ongoingly in California and elsewhere, but that's another one that I think needs regulation broadly. And then I'll just add on top of what we were saying before about the preemption issue of whether or not states can do their own stronger rules around chemicals. That is one limitation of the new law, is that it will limit the flexibility that California and other states have had up until now to be able to have their own stronger chemical policies. So I think that we'll see how that plays out, but I was disappointed to see that in the final law, since I think, as we've seen, you know, a lot of ways, so goes California, so goes the nation. We see California make rules about specific chemicals, and manufacturers will often just make the products everywhere meet the standard in California, since that's easier for them than to have meet different standards. And so it will be interesting to see how that plays out and which chemicals the EPA chooses.
Right, because according to reports, the manufacturers and the industry decided to get behind this law because they did not want to comply with a patchwork of state chemical laws.
Right, right.
And so can you talk a little bit more about that? Because Senator Barbara Boxer has done a lot of work in this area, and she was opposed to this law specifically for these reasons.
Yeah, it does present a challenge, particularly for states like California, Washington, Connecticut, Maine, a few others that have really taken the lead on reviewing new chemicals and setting the bar higher than what's happening at the national level. And as we've seen, where the EPA has not acted under the old law, there was the opportunity for states to step up and make this stronger. And so I know Senator Boxer worked very hard on this and tried to get exemptions for California's efforts to be continued, and largely the bill does have some, or the law rather, does have carve-outs that allow California to continue a lot of its programs, like the Proposition 65 that Dr. Woodruff mentioned. So this has this does have some places in the new law that allow states to continue, but the hope is that what this new law doesn't do is create new national standards that are weaker than the state standards that do exist, and would force the whole nation to follow the weaker federal standard as opposed to a stronger state standard. And I think that remains to be seen, but that's certainly the fear among many groups, including my own, about how that will play out.
Dr. Woodruff, when we did our week-long series on chemicals, we talked about the very powerful chemical industry. And mm-hmm. These are companies like DuPont, Dow. And according to the Smithsonian, to push for their preferred version of reform, the chemical industry spent more than $125 million on lobbying since 2014.
That's a lot of money.
Yes.
I mean, I think it just speaks to, I think the money that they're spending to have their best in to advance what their interests are in the chemical policy reform speaks to how important they know that the federal regulation is going to be to how they, their ability to manufacture and use certain chemicals. So I'm pretty sure the environmental health community spent just a fraction of that on this bill. I just wanted to also pick up on the this preemption issue, because preemption comes up a lot in other contexts. The Affordable Health Care Act also, there were some preemption issues in there. And one of the things that's really interesting is that this has been discussed in other venues. Regulating tobacco preemption is also an issue that has also come up. And the Institute of Medicine actually did a report about preemption where they recommended that preemption in general is not a good idea, because it tends to act against the interests of the public's health, because it limits the ability of localities, whether it's states, government, cities, or counties, to have flexible and policies that meet the needs of their constituencies. And also it just limits the level of innovation that's going to be happening around the United States, because I think the point that Dr. Goldman made in terms of California being a leader, California is also an innovator, which allows for good ideas to be developed as almost like laboratories that then can spread to other places in the United States. So preemption just generally is not a good idea for, and particularly can be a problem for public health. So I think this issue about preempting these chemicals, once EPA declares them not to be an unreasonable risk, could have repercussions down the road. And that's why the focus on how EPA is going to be doing their decision making is going to be so important. And the timeline for that is actually going to be very quick, because EPA has to set out the ground rules of how they're going to be evaluating the science essentially over the next year or two.
We're going to take a quick break. Today we are talking about the chemicals that we use on a daily basis, whether it's chemicals in our shampoo, chemicals in the liquid that we use to wash our clothing, to wash our dishes, things that we use to wash the bathroom with. All of these products have chemicals in them. And do you know if they're safe? 84,000 chemicals have been registered for commercial use, but the EPA has regulated just 9. That is far less than 1%. President Obama recently signed a bill to amend the Toxic Substances Control Act of 1976. And today we are talking about whether this bill will give the EPA the power that it needs to regulate chemicals to ensure safety. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call. On the telephone, by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, going to our website, yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us to our Twitter handle @yourcallradio. If you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone, you may call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Coming up in a half an hour, BBC World Have Your Say will be looking at the economic and political turmoil in Venezuela. Half hour from now at 11 o'clock here on 91.7 KLW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will be talking about what happens to veterans once they return home. Politicians at the recent conventions talked about the importance of taking care of veterans. But who's really pushing for legislation that addresses trauma, violent behavior, suicide? More than 90,000 soldiers have been deployed to a combat zone 4 or more times. This is the largest number in modern history. So, a decade after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan and Iraq, why haven't these issues been seriously addressed? That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us today, we're talking about the chemicals that we use on a daily basis and whether or not the law that was signed by President Obama recently to amend the Toxic Substances Control Act will seriously address this issue. What will really change with this new law? Will it give the EPA the power that it needs to regulate hazardous chemicals? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet @yourcallradio. Today we're joined by Dr. Tracy Woodruff, professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at UC San Francisco, and Dr. Gretchen Goldman, lead analyst in the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And we have a number of emails about this. Rob wants to talk about EPA funding. Is there anything in the new legislation allowing the EPA to fund their testing and enforcement through fees or other methods? The current method of funding allows Congress to strangle any agency they choose by reducing the agency's budget. And in the 2017 fiscal year bill, the Republicans wanted to cut EPA funding by about $164 million. You're in Washington, Dr. Goldman. What are your thoughts on this issue?
This is certainly an issue that people have been concerned about ongoingly when this bill was under discussion. In the final law, we have in there a sustained source of funding that is dedicated for the purpose of this issue, and also that comes from appropriations, so Congress will have a a line item in there for this purpose. And also, they're getting additional money from industry user fees. So this is a significant improvement in that it does give the EPA sustained targeted funding for this program, which is far better than what we had previously. I'll just note, I think, as perhaps the listener was also alluding to, is that there is, of course, always the risk of things changing, and appropriations are a big political fight ongoingly, and there's always the possibility of additional attacks on legislation from Congress and efforts to weaken the EPA in a broader sense, or perhaps could be targeting this particular program, but there is the potential of attacks leading to changes. But as of at the moment, there is dedicated funding to this.
And Dr. Woodruff, anything to add there on funding?
No, I think it's critical for funding, but I think just the overall issue that the writer was alluding to, which is that EPA, actually, their employee levels have gone down tremendously since over the last 10 years, and their funding has also gone down. And you think about the, I think that it's true and it's great that there's dedicated funding for the implementation of TSCA, but there's other parts of EPA that'll have to be involved to help with the, like, deciding a lot about the science and things like that. And it's just, I think it's going to be a challenge for EPA just to, in general, to manage the workload that they have under the current configuration of their funding.
And Dr. Goldman, what about the independence of the EPA? How much power do the people who work at the EPA have to really tackle this issue? Because one of your colleagues, or actually, yeah, some of your colleagues at the Union of Concerned Scientists had a report called Bad Chemistry, How the Chemical Industries Trade Association Undermines the Policies That Protect Us. And in this report, we learn that in the 2013-2014 election cycle, nearly 70% of the American Chemistry Council's registered federal lobbyists had previously held jobs in Congress or in the executive branch. So there's a big revolving door here between the chemical industry and Washington.
There is. There's a large revolving door, and we see the American Chemistry Council, which is largely the trade association that speaks for the chemical industry broadly. They have played a big role, and they continue to play a big role on anything chemical-related in Congress, and this has ultimately has a big influence on what happens on the Hill when we talk about chemical policy. We've seen them certainly try very hard to influence the EPA and a lot of its chemical decision making, and so I think this is something we'll need to monitor as this law starts to be implemented. We'll need to make sure that the agency does have the sufficient independence to be able to conduct this. One positive piece in that regard on the new law is that the EPA is now required to conduct a solely health-based risk assessment, as Dr. Woodruff mentioned, and so that should, in theory, allow for some separation between what the science concludes and then looking more on the policy side of how do we manage those chemicals, what sorts of costs are going to be associated with that management, but there is that line between the health-based risk assessment and the policy conversation, and so hopefully that should allow for a little more independence of the agency, but I think this is something that will need to be monitored and we'll need to watch to make sure there is not additional inappropriate influence from the chemical industry on this.
All right. Well, thank you for your email, Rob. And you can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also give us a call, 866-798-8255. When you think about the products that are under your sink or the products that you put on your body on a regular basis, do you know what chemicals are in these products? If you have any questions about this, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email at Your Call Radio. And we have a question from Denise about bottled water. She says, 29 billion plastic water bottles are sold in the U.S. every year. These bottles leach chemicals into the water from the plastic. It is known that bacteria form, especially when the bottle is warm. These bottles have a no-buy date, so you don't know how long this item has been on the shelf. In fact, you don't even know where the water comes from. 40% comes from municipal sources. Thus, we are paying twice for water you can get out of your tap. Dr. Woodruff, what about this? We're often told not to buy bottled water if it's been sitting for a long time, but once it hits the store shelf, you have no idea what the bottle went through to get to the store. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so this is a drinking water and bottled water is an interesting issue. I think some environmental groups have looked at this issue periodically over the last 10 years and measuring what chemicals might be in the bottled water. It's not really well regulated. But in terms of the relationship to TSCA, where EPA could go on this is to take the chemicals that are used in those plastic water bottles and do an evaluation or assessment of those chemicals, and then the use would be bottled water, and in theory EPA could look at, okay, what chemicals are used in those bottles, do the use would be the bottled water, and then they would look at, okay, what's the exposure that people have to these chemicals via bottled water, and then look at the risks from that perspective. I think it's important to think about, actually just to key back to the issue about how EPA is going to be looking at this first from a science perspective, which is great. I think the challenge is that Congress left the how EPA, what kind of the floors are for how EPA should evaluate the science open to EPA's interpretation. And I think that's where we're going to see a lot of activity about how is EPA going to make certain decisions about how they're going to use the science. So a perfect example in the bottled water case is, let's say that the bottle, they're using BPA in this, in the plastic, and EPA goes to do to look at the risks from BPA from the plastics in the plastic water bottle that gets into the water that people drink. Now, the reality is that people are exposed to, in this case, let's say it's BPA, they're exposed to BPA from multiple sources. So, will EPA just look at the risks from BPA in that from that water bottle? That would be one risk. Or will they consider that BPA from that water bottle in addition to the other BPA sources that they're being exposed to, like the receipts and the can linings? Because how they do that will make a difference. If they just look at the water bottle risks, it might not be that much, but it could be enough if it's added with the other BPA sources. EPA is not required to look at what this is called, which is aggregate sources of the chemical exposure, like BPA from the water bottle, from the receipt, and then from the can lining. They are required to tell in the risk assessment how they did, whether or not they looked at it. But it's a big difference because in previous, like the last law that was passed by Congress, the Food Quality Protection Act, EPA is required to look at both this aggregate issue from multiple chemical exposures and to look at, well, if I'm exposed to BPA and phthalates at the same time, which we know is true from biomonitoring studies, what does that mean in terms of the risk from BPA? Does that increase my risk when I get exposed to an additional chemical on top of the chemical soup I'm already exposed to? So I think those are some of the science things that are being left open to EPA, and it's there's going to be a lot of pressure on EPA, particularly as you were just saying from that the chemical industry has been investing a lot of money in this, and so they will be there giving their interpretation of the science. And I think I think this is really tricky because if you have EPA and their decision is being hot, there's a lot of pressure on EPA to make a certain decision. But once they make that decision, there's nothing left, and they say it's not a risk. There's nothing left for the states to do on this, so they can't second guess that, and it's very difficult because we're basically concentrating power in this one place in Washington, D.C., which may end up being problematic down the road. We'll have to see how it goes.
And what about the relationship between the EPA and various groups like Breast Cancer Action, for example, the Environmental Working Group, your group, Dr. Goldman, the Union of Concerned Scientists, because these organizations have done really incredible work over the years to inform the public about these chemicals. So is there a relationship between these organizations and the EPA? I mean, can the organization come and say, hey, we've done the work. Here's our data. Now, please take action on this. Dr. Goldman?
Certainly, there's a role for nonprofit groups or other health or environmental advocacy groups to play here. Moving forward, we know that the EPA will have to issue a rulemaking period to determine how it's going to prioritize chemicals and how it's ultimately going to implement this new law. And so that that rulemaking period and each time EPA proposes a new chemical under this law, those will all be opportunities for the public and groups and the industry to weigh in on the decisions. And so those will be times where groups can recommend EPA look at certain chemicals, prioritize certain ones over others, and they'll have an opportunity to get data from all relevant actors that have anything to share. I think this will also be a really important point for the EPA to hear from the scientific community and what sort of studies and information they can get from academic literature and any sort of comprehensive studies that have been done on these chemicals. I think this hopefully will provide a lot of places where there is can get public input, and we can have a more of a conversation between the nonprofit community and the agency along with the public.
Dr. Gretchen Goldman is a lead analyst in the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and Dr. Tracy Woodruff is professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at UC San Francisco. Today, we are talking about chemicals and our everyday products. The Toxic Substances Control Act of 1976 has finally been updated and amended after years of advocates asking Congress to take action. They say that it was a weak law and did not go far enough to help the public or to actually make these products safe. And so environmental groups say this new law doesn't go far enough, but it's a step. At least it's been amended. The chemical industry says that it does go far enough, and they decided to step in and support this, according to reports, because they didn't want to have to follow 50 state laws. They wanted one law at the national level. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about this, if you have any questions about everyday products that you use, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Marie Louise in Palo Alto. Hi, Marie Louise. Welcome to the show.
I am calling to say that years and years ago, when, pretty much when fabric softeners had only just been on the market for a short time, I'm from Sweden, but I didn't live in Sweden at that time, but it was pretty much banned nearly because of its effect on skin, on water. You know, many people would use it for babies if if they thought the baby needed softer clothes. So anyway, I think we should think about that also. I have never used it in my life, but that's something to think about. And if I can mention one other thing very quickly, it's the antibacterial everythings that are out, which I hear is very harmful for the water because our water processing, as it's going to be cleaned, does not know how to take care of that. So it can affect fish and all kinds of water. Life.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Marie Louise. Yeah, the Environmental Working Group has a piece called Don't Get Slimed, Skip the Fabric Softener. It says, according to studies, there people get asthma after using this. There are ingredients like phthalates and synthetic musks. These are suspected hormone disruptors. And also, according to the EWG, if you feel like you cannot live without that extra softness, try using a half a cup of white vinegar per load and then rinse the cycle as a natural fabric softener. Dr. Woodruff, I mean, it takes people time to look up these things, but once you do, it's pretty easy to find the information, and almost always there are alternatives.
Yeah, I was just listening to you read that. First of all, I've been in this field for many years, and this hearing the fabric softener story, it's like, oh, yeah, okay, it does make sense that there are probably chemicals in the fabric softener, I haven't personally looked into it, but then when you say, oh, yes, there's these chemicals like phthalates and musk, that totally makes sense, and that it's something that right now is completely unregulated and could be a candidate for evaluation under the new law. So that's a really good example of where we have something that's not well characterized, could end up being characterized. I think it also brings up the other issue which you were raising, which is right now the burden is on us, is on the consumer. We work with clinicians here, a lot of doctors here. The burden's on them to try and figure out how to manage these thousands of chemicals that are in all these different products that we come into contact with. And I think one of the huge drivers of this is to try and shift that burden of proof on to, ideally, we work with obstetricians, and they have a professional society, the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, who issued a statement about 2 years ago saying this issue about toxic chemicals is enough. We need to do something about it, and the burden of proof should be on the manufacturers, not on consumers, not on the medical doctors, not on the public, to essentially prove these chemicals are safe before they get into our everyday products. Will the TSCA bill address this? Well, it will move in that direction, but you know, the existing chemicals are going to be assessed at, I think the list is a minimum of 20 at a time. There are probably 6,000 high-use chemicals. So even if you follow that, they go through and let's just say they are able to assess them at that pace, it's still going to be very slow. So we're still going to be left managing these types of things like, should I be using vinegar in my as a fabric softener or not?
Right. And Dr. Goldman, I mean, the sad reality is we all have to have these mini EPAs in our homes, and we have to do most of the research on our own. A lot of guests in the past have said, less is more. Just don't use as much stuff. That's one of the first things you can do. But as someone who just had a baby, I mean, what advice would you give to listeners who feel overwhelmed by all of these labels?
Right. It's very daunting. There's lots of labels, and a lot of times the labels aren't necessarily telling you anything. I mean, there's limited labeling requirements, and so there's lots of times when they don't even have to tell you if it contains any chemical that you might be looking for or concerned about. So yeah, I mean, this is a giant jungle of trying to figure out what's safe and what isn't, and I certainly found the extent of that when I was pregnant and trying to determine. I think I first just want to make the point that this is part of this legacy that we're now living in because of that original passage of TSCA in 1976, because when we passed that, we grandfathered in some 62,000 chemicals that were already on the marketplace at that time. And so basically what the EPA said then was, we're going to assume that everything already on the marketplace is safe and just think about chemicals regulating the ones that are come on board onto the marketplace moving forward. And so already we're starting with this history of having many, many chemicals that haven't been regulated. And so I would recommend that anyone interested would try to find scientific sources of information. There's a couple nonprofits out there that work a lot on these issues, as Rose mentioned, and some specific groups that have looked into this. So try to get back to a scientific source if you can. Scientists have been studying these and then think about this and to a varying degree. And so there's a lot out there, and it's certainly not easy to figure out, but there have been people working hard on this. And so if you can find them, you can at least chip away and start to be a slightly more informed consumer.
We're almost out of time, but Judy wanted to write in about the effect on animal testing. The Humane Society had a press release saying that this bill could ultimately eliminate animal testing. It could save hundreds of thousands of animals from having harsh chemicals rubbed into their skin, forced down their throats, and dropped in their eyes.
That is a unique feature of this bill. It did does discourage use of animal testing, and so I think we'll see what effect that ultimately has on the research that's done. But I think there is less of a need as we develop more and more tools for testing chemicals, and I'm not sure if Dr. Woodruff has other points to add about that.
Yeah, I would say that, of course, minimizing the use of animals when we're testing or any type of experimental when we don't need them is a good goal. Mm-hmm. I think the challenge is that we're not there yet in terms of being able to identify a toxic chemical from just tests that are done in cellular cultures right now. And so right now, I mean, before the passage of the bill, we essentially were doing a big experiment on ourselves because we let all these chemicals come out and then we're studying them post hoc. I think using this, I don't think we're at the place where scientifically we can get away from using animal testing, though of course we should be looking at how we can be, whether we to achieve that goal in the future. So I think that is, I think that's a good goal, but I think we're not there yet, and we need to be mindful of making sure how are we going to decide when we're there? That, I think, is going to be another big area of debate when EPA is looking at the implementation.
Well, thank you for the email. It's an important issue, Judy, and we'll definitely do a show about that in the future. We don't have time to take your call, Susan, but Susan wanted to say the act does not go far enough. Please talk more about Prop 65. We only have a minute left, but if you can talk about this, Dr. Woodruff, since you're in California, under Prop 65, the state must publish a list of chemicals known to cause cancer, birth defects, or other reproductive harm. I have seen this on products. I've seen it on signs. It's a little confusing because you wonder, what does this mean exactly?
Well, yes. So once the state has identified a chemical that's a known reproductive developmental toxin or a carcinogen, the stores are required to provide a label saying that. If they don't provide the label, there's a lawsuit mechanism which allows a kind of a remedy within the legal system. California is actually currently updating those labeling that people see everywhere so that they're a little bit more specific, so they tell you what the chemical is, what's the use, and what is the exact concern. I agree that it's a little, the way it had been implemented up until really recently, it's a little vague, but I think it illustrates the point that because you see so many labels, there's actually a lot of toxic chemicals that are out and about in our everyday lives. And that's something we want, that I think everyone's goal is to address, because the reality is we're seeing a lot of challenges, health challenges, particularly among children. And I think one of the big drivers in terms of dealing with toxic chemicals is trying to reduce whatever the burden is that's being produced by toxic chemicals on children's health and basically the health of the population.
Well, we will definitely continue to follow this issue. And if you feel overwhelmed because we've been talking about so many chemicals, there are some great websites out there that give you the information you need. And it doesn't take that much time. It does take time, but at least it's out there for you to check out. The EWG.org is one of the best ones. Dr. Tracy Woodruff is professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at UC San Francisco. And Dr. Gretchen Goldman is lead analyst in the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Dr. Goldman and Dr. Woodruff, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Jour Call, we're talking about what happens to veterans once they return home. More than 90,000 soldiers have been deployed to a combat zone four or more times. Politicians at the recent conventions talked about the importance of taking care of vets, but who's pushing for legislation that addresses trauma, PTSD, violent behavior, and suicide? A decade after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan and Iraq, why haven't these issues been seriously addressed? It's Jour Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.